The Friday Reporter launched in March of 2021 as a conversation with today's journalists and has expanded to include newsmakers, lawmakers, image makers, and just about anybody who's in the news or the news adjacent business. The podcast is in partnership with PR Daily and is part of the Big Wig Podcast Network. If you like the show, please hit the subscribe button to make sure you've got ready access to the latest conversation. And if you've got an idea for a great guest, don't forget to send your ideas to Lisa at FridayReporter.com. Well, hello, and thank you so much for joining me for another episode of the Friday Reporter podcast. Today's guest is a guest who I just admitted to before we got on the call today. I have become a fan of her work, not only because I really buy into the research and the work and the whole concept that she's been advancing for what seems like a big part of her career, but I've actually begun to follow Emily Hanford, who is a senior producer and a correspondent for APM Reports, but also host of the hit podcast Sold a Story. For those of you who are my friends who have teenage children in the school system, you will recognize some of what we talk about today. This podcast not only is the second most shared show on Apple Podcasts from 23, it's Time Magazine's top three podcasts of the year. And just, I mean, I could go on for on and on and on, Emily, but thanks so much for joining me today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
So the whole point and the whole sort of the piece that sort of got me to follow and really sort of dive into the work that you're doing is the concept of how reading and the approach to teaching of reading has evolved over the course of time, probably since the time when you and I were in school and before that. Tell me though about how you got started and how you got sort of into this line of reporting.
Well, every time I'm asked this question, I think about how far back should I go? You know, because we all know that in life and in our careers, you know, one thing leads to another.
Yeah.
But the Sold a Story podcast in particular, which came out at the end of 2022, and we are continuing to produce it. There were a couple more episodes that came out last spring, and we're working on a couple more episodes right now. That podcast was really the result of an accumulating set of questions that had been I had been sort of collecting over my years as a reporter. I've been an education reporter for quite a long time, since 2008. I've been working for American Public Media. And I've always been able to do long form, like documentary kind of pieces. So there were always like big questions that would come out of one documentary to the next. And most of the reporting that I did was focused on older students and questions around like preparation for college and how high schools were doing and the extent to which education and schooling in America sort of does or doesn't kind of contribute to social mobility and sort of a more equitable society. Like, I feel like those are sort of questions that were always underlying what I was working on. But I got into this reading thing about 6 years ago now, and Sold a Story was a podcast that really came after several years of reporting on it and doing some other pieces. And then I just had all these questions about how did it happen? How did it, because what I basically sort of was able to show, and I wouldn't really say I uncovered, I feel like it's kind of been this thing that's been hiding in plain sight for a long time, mm-hmm. that the way that many kids are taught to read doesn't align very well with what's actually been learned about how people learn to read and what it takes to be a good reader. And that's really been off for quite a long time. And Sold a Story was really my attempt to figure out how that happened. Mm. How is it that there has been this really fascinating large body of research, a lot of it coming from cognitive science, but a lot of it coming from other areas too. Research is all over the world over the past like 50 years or so. Mm-hmm. So I'm in my early 50s. So mm-hmm. a lot of this stuff started really taking off right around the time I was starting to learn how to read.
Yeah.
And there's really just this huge disconnect between what the scientific research has shown and what's actually happening in schools. So Sold a Story is about how that happened. Mm.
And I alluded to it as I was getting started and mentioned to you earlier, my mom was a special ed teacher. And for years, as my kids were even learning early on, the one thing she pointed to are some of the real sort of fundamentals of what you have really begun to uncover. And so that alone, it was like hearing the voice of my mom, really, which was kind of great because I miss her every day. But also, too, it really was coming through in what I was seeing in my own children, who are now, you know, in their later years in high school and going on to college. And reading is one of those real struggles that they have always really sort of grappled with, not just because there was a lack of interest. I remember being a kid. I mean, also too, there were no video games and there were no, cause you, it sounds like you and I are about the same age in life, and none of that was available. So the library and books were really sort of a big part of our life coming up. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about American Public Media and about the organization that you're with today.
Sure. Yeah. So American Public Media is public radio, basically. And it's actually Minnesota Public Radio. I have never lived in Minnesota my entire life. I live outside of Washington, D.C., and I've lived in Chicago and North Carolina and Boston. But Minnesota Public Radio is a very strong public radio institution that's been around for a long time, and they have a national programming unit that has been called various things since I've been there, but we are now called APM Reports. We're a national documentary investigative reporting team doing audio primarily, although not only. So we did a lot of radio programs and radio specials, and now we do a lot of podcasting. Awesome. So it's a nonprofit public media organization. I've always worked in public media my entire life. I was an English major in college with no real plan about what was going to happen after college and completely freaked out by it, and happened to get an internship at the public radio station in the town where I went to college. And I've always worked in public radio ever since.
That's awesome.
Early 90s when we were still cutting up there was a typewriter in my first newsroom, and we were cutting up audio tape, and there were razor blades, and I was lived in a little hippy dippy town, and we walked around in the summer without our shoes on in the office, but you could, you know, you could step on a razor blade and slice your heel open. So
the killer instinct of radio.
Yeah.
That's so cool. And so, and that's interesting you say now that it has really sort of evolved into podcasting as well. Talk to me a little bit about your process in terms of the show itself. So are you doing just the show? You're obviously doing reporting in addition to the show. Tell me a little bit about sort of your day to day, because I'd love to get back to sort of talking specifically about the podcast, but I'm also curious about how you balance all of that.
Such a good question. I don't know what the answer is. I mean, Sold a Story is a narrative podcast that came out in a season, right? So it's the 6 episodes in its first season. And then, as I said, there are these other episodes we've done, and we're working on either a new set of episodes. It might be a new season. We're sort of trying to figure that out right now. Mm-hmm. So my job varies a lot sort of day to day. Since Sold a Story came out, which was over a year ago now, a lot of what I've been doing since then is following the reaction to it. That's some of what we've done in our episodes. I've been doing a lot of public speaking, being a lot of guests on podcasts. I think this is, there's a real interest in this topic among the general public. So I would say that this reporting that I was doing on reading and what has been learned and what people are now talking about, the science of reading, I would say some of my early reporting before Sold a Story was some pretty basic sort of explanatory journalism, and was getting a lot of interest from people who had some reason to be interested in it. Mm-hmm. Parents of kids who struggled with reading, and we can go back to that. I have some things to say about what you were saying about your own children, which we can maybe return to. But I would say people who already had some reason to be interested. So that's a lot of parents of struggling readers, and many teachers who know, many of them know in their gut that they don't know, that they're not really teaching reading as well as they could or should, and that there are some kids are doing fine, and we'll get back to that.
Yeah.
And in some, for some teachers, many kids do fine, but many teachers know in their gut that there are always kids. And for some teachers, it's a lot of their kids who they know they're not really teaching them how to read. So I would say the work was really reaching that audience. And then Sold a Story, I think, took it to sort of a new level in terms of the just general interest. Like, I think a lot of people listen to it, and people write to me. I'm not a teacher. I don't have kids. I didn't think I cared about how kids are taught to read, but I couldn't stop listening to Sold a Story because of the story it told.
Yeah.
So of course, that's one of the things that's really important about our work, is there's a huge lift in terms of the amount of reporting and documents and all of the stuff that we have to find out and all of the questions we have to answer. But at the end of the day, it's like, well, can you deliver all of that through a story, through a narrative? That's what makes people care. That's why people want to keep listening. And that's what I was trying to do with this work. I mean, I was just writing something actually this morning. I feel, and I've, this, my editor probably won't like this, but I feel a little bit like I want this work. I feel like this work is sort of like an appetizer. Like, here you go. Like, there's some fascinating stuff here that all kinds of people, teachers, parents, and policymakers, and the general public really need to know about what, how people learn to read, and why there are a decent number of people who struggle, and how schools have been teaching it generally, and why there's this disconnect. And there's all this stuff you should know. And here's an appetizer. And go now, there's a big meal to be had further on. Like, I can't deliver everything to you in this podcast. But what I can do is bring you along, tell you some of the things that have been learned, and tell you the stories of why it matters. And of course, children are being harmed because they're not getting the reading instruction they need. And I think that's a very hard message for parent for teachers in particular to hear. But I think that's one of the things that we really that I recognized early on, and really we dug into and sold a story. And that's what you do with investigative journalism. Something's being harmed, and there are people, entities that need to be held to account for that. And that's what we tried to do and sold a story.
Oh, that's fantastic. But I have to ask, public radio is notorious for having a lot of work to do and only so many people to do it. So how big is the team that you work with on the show?
It's pretty small. It's
I
me and
suspected that,
a full-time co-reporter, and then we have a great team of people in APM Reports that work with us on parts of it, but are also working on lots of other projects. So we have like two of us are sort of dedicated to this full-time, and then we have various editors and audio editors and others who have worked with us, but it's a very small team. That's actually really the way I like to work. I mean, in some ways, I think there's a lot of reporting to be done, and I'd really like to think of ways to scale this up. I think I work best when I can sort of really intensely focus on the work itself. Like, I remember even as we were doing Sold a Story, we made this huge timeline, which is what reporters usually do when they're trying to organize information. And ours is goes back to the 1600s and has like, I don't know, 3,000 entries in it or something. It's something massively overwhelming. And my co-reporter Christopher Peake has been the master of keeping that timeline. But I remember at one point as we were sort of getting, starting to write it and put it together, as I was like, oh my God, like all this information has to sort of go through my brain at some point. Like, I'm the person who has to sort of figure this out and write it. And so it took us longer than we thought. I mean, and we almost, it was actually so hard. It felt so hard at a certain point. These projects actually, they're successful if they don't seem like they were hard to write. We get it down into some really simple sentences, and we really can convey this in a way. When you're doing audio, you really have to write in a way where you don't lose anyone. Like, when you're reading something, you don't realize that this is one of the things that comes out of the reading research, right? You skip around a lot. You can read a newspaper article or a magazine article. Someone's mentioned, you're like, wait, who was that guy? And then you go back to the top and be like, well, who was he? In radio, you can't do that. You have to write in a way where it's unfolding very like slowly and clearly, and you're constantly reminding people, and it's hard to do. And when it and so we almost gave up. We really almost did. And I'm glad we didn't, because it's had a bigger impact than I thought it would, for sure.
I feel like too, so much of the focus after the pandemic and the impact on education was really, really like your timing on releasing the show too, while probably has, and I'd be interested to hear some of the contours and some of the things, the intersections that you've learned, but the timing too really was as if you sort of caught lightning in a bottle, because a lot of people were really, really talking about the impact of education and so there was an additional emphasis on top of all of the good research that you've done, where people were starting to really sort of look again more closely at how that alone, the isolation and the separation and all of the other pieces of pandemic and quarantine really had on our students, but also too then knowing that even the research that we now know to be true from that is also quite a bit more impacted by the fact that there is also a much, much longer trajectory of impact that's been going on long before there was that sort of moment in time.
Yeah, I mean, of course, we were starting the production of this while the pandemic was going on. Mm-hmm. So like with many people, at first we thought it was going to be a major obstacle. Like suddenly we couldn't go anywhere. Yeah. You know, like audio reporting very much is about being in places and things, seeing things happen, and suddenly we couldn't go anywhere. So at first I thought this is a disaster. Like, yeah, how are we going to get this project done? As you know, and then you realize that there are ways around it, and you know, there are ways to get good audio. I've discovered new ways to get good audio without going anywhere, and ways that you can tell stories without being in places. And I think what we realized is, oh, there's actually something happening with this topic right now. So as you can hear in Sold a Story, one of the things that I think happened during the pandemic is that a number of parents were suddenly in the classroom with their first graders and second graders. And one of the things that happens when you're a parent of a child and you send them off to school, for the most part, you don't really know what happens. You just sort of trust that they're going to school and they're going to get what they need. And they're going to, for example, certainly be taught how to read. Yeah. I don't think most parents think that their kids aren't going to be taught how to read.
Right.
And I think what happened during the pandemic is not all parents, this was many parents were juggling all kinds of things. And this was part of the problem with the pandemic. There was no one to sit there next to the kid and help them, you know, get on Zoom. But there were a number of parents who were sitting next to their kid for some of that time watching on Zoom, and they were seeing the reading instruction. Mm. And they were saying like, why are they doing it like that? Mm-hmm. Why is my kid being taught to read like that? And at that point, they could then go to Google, like, why is my child being taught to, what is this way my child is being taught to read? And what they came up with were things I have written and many other people, right? So one of the reasons that I've been able to do this reporting is that a tremendous amount has been written by this topic, accessible books and articles that are there. So this combination of more parents were seeing it, and this is an important thing too. These are what I think happened is a broader spectrum of parents were seeing the problem. Mm-hmm. So one thing that happens is you have a kid who goes to school. Sort of reading ability and how difficult it is for you to learn how to read is very much on a spectrum, right? Some of us learn to read very easily. Some of us don't. Most of us are somewhere in the middle, and it doesn't have to do with intelligence. That's what's really important to recognize. There are very smart kids who have a hard time learning how to read. What happens is for those kids who are on the sort of side of it where learning to read is really hard, their parents do usually figure out. Sometimes it feels like it's kind of late, like second grade, third grade, fourth grade, they start to realize like, hey, this kid is really behind. Why is this kid struggling? Then they get into this sort of big battle with the school about what's going on. And that's a whole other story.
Sure.
But I think what happened, I think what happened during the pandemic is there were just a number of parents of kids who may have ultimately been fine. Some of the kids in Sold a Story may have been fine, but still their parents were watching them going, why is she being taught to read that way?
Yeah.
And that I think is a really important question for everyone to ask, because many kids are fine. It doesn't really matter how you teach them to read, but two things. One thing you realize is that there are lots of kids who aren't getting the instruction they need in school. And some kids have this backup, and that backup is their parents, who will teach them to read themselves at home, mm-hmm. or in many cases pay for tutors, $40 sure. an hour, $80 an hour. Maybe they'll pay for private schools. And so we realize there's this real inequity. There's lots of kids not getting the instruction they need. Some kids have this backup plan, which is their parents and their parents' checkbooks. Mm-hmm. Most kids don't have that backup plan. Mm-hmm. Some proportion of those kids are going to be fine because it doesn't matter how you teach them to read. Some of them are really going to struggle and really be messed up by this. And then a whole lot of kids are just kind of limping along. And these might be your kids, for example. Mm-hmm. Probably your kids are not way on that spectrum of having dyslexia. I'm just guessing based on what you told me, right? It seems like they're doing okay.
Yep.
But they probably are, like most of us, kids who needed more and better instruction when they were little and didn't get it. And so there are things that they don't know about how written language works. And they've picked up a certain amount of it through some instruction at school and a lot of stuff you sort of teach yourself on your own through reading. But if you don't get off to a good start with reading, you tend to not like reading. Mm-hmm. And there are other competing factors. It's very true in our culture today, right? But if you don't sort of like reading from the beginning, you really start to miss out on all of this self-teaching that does ultimately happen. Like a lot of what we all know about reading does sort of happen implicitly, but it requires like sort of someone showing you the way it works early on. And that's what's been missing in schools for a long time. And it's not all just phonics instruction, because one of the reasons I made Sold a Story was really to try to help people understand that this is not just about phonics, because many, many schools have been adding in some phonics instruction. Like you'll go to most schools and they'll tell you they do some phonics. The question is, what is the phonics they're doing? Is it enough? Is it good enough? Is it structured enough? And are they also teaching kids this other thing, which we focus on Sold a Story, which is, well, you don't have to sound out the written words because you can do these other things to figure out the words,
Sure.
what the words say. And what we show in Sold a Story is why that's such a problem. Because really, to become a good reader, you have to get all these words into your brain, and it really happens most efficiently, most effectively, most successfully through sound, laboriously sounding out a written word, connecting the sounds and the word with the spelling of the word and the meaning of the word. And when those three things are connected in your brain, you can like map that word into your memory. And you and I are good readers because tens of thousands of words are mapped into our memory because we sort of this thing went through our mind where we sort of glued together those three things about a word, the way it sounds, the way it's spelled, and
And
what
what
it
it
means.
means.
And if kids are missing any part of that, they kind of can't get that glue that makes those words really automatic to them. And that's so key because when the words aren't a problem for you, you can focus on the meaning of what you're reading. And that's the point, right? But a lot of kids, by the time they get to high school, they can read, but they're still struggling with the words. They haven't gotten them down. There's a lot of automaticity that's missing, and they're really not. Their brain is being like overtaxed by the reading process because they're spending too much time focusing on figuring out the words rather than just being able to focus on the meaning of what they're reading.
Oh, that's
And that I
fascinating.
think, you know, like I think I learned to read pretty easily. I was in first grade in 1976, I think in a classroom that was, I don't remember being taught how to read. I don't remember really being taught any phonics. I think we were at the sort of early edge of a very sort of woo-woo kind of way of doing it, which is you don't get a lot of instruction. You just sort of give kids lots of books and expect that through time on task and through a motivation and desire to do it, they'll become good readers. And some of us do. I did. I also benefited from the fact that my mother had been a first grade teacher who knew she hadn't taught kids how to read and had bought all these little decodable books that were all around my house, and we would read them all the time. So I got a certain amount of instruction at home.
Oh, that's so, it's
So
so
anyway, and
true.
I hadn't really thought about this because my kids, I think, were sort of different. I think one of them was one of those ones who almost learned to read automatically. It was like magic. I was like, where did this come from? The other one struggled a little bit, but he was definitely one of those. It all came together in time, no problem. If
Sure.
he'd gotten better instruction, I think it could have been more effective, more efficient. He would have been reading better, quicker, but he's fine. And so my kids are in their 20s now. And I really hadn't thought about this at all. And then when I started thinking about it, when I started realizing, like, oh, I'm taking for granted, I didn't need much instruction. My kids didn't need much instruction. But a lot of people need better instruction, more instruction than they're getting in school. What does this mean? What is this meaning? And what it really means is huge. We're contributing to inequality in a huge way because there's so much tutoring, there's so much extra stuff that some parents can provide if their kids are struggling in school. And then it's just like, but what about all the other kids?
No question about it. What have you found in terms of reaction to sharing this information? What kinds of reactions have you gotten from educators and from lawmakers? Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, it's certainly a message that's hard for many teachers to hear at first. But and obviously it varies how teachers hear this. But what I'll say is that what I see on social media and what I see in my email inbox and what I hear from teachers I talk to is that for many teachers, this is such a revelation for them. And while it can be hard and they feel tremendous pain and guilt actually at first, because these teachers can remember the faces and the names of the kids that they know that they didn't teach how to read, and those faces and names come flooding back to them. My mother can remember the names of the people that she didn't teach how to read in the early 1960s, when she was actually one of the first whole language teachers, when some of these ideas, like, oh, we don't really need to teach them how to read, they'll figure it out. She was one of the first people to try that. And she wasn't a first grade teacher for very long, partly for that reason. Like she just, she, you know, So it's difficult for teachers to hear this at first, but I think for many teachers, it's actually ultimately very invigorating. Like I have actually heard from teachers who've been teaching for 20, 30 years who say, this is the most exciting time in my career. I'm intellectually stimulated. This is what I want to tell anyone listening right now. This whole science of reading stuff, it's fascinating. We have a
Yeah.
reading list on our website, soldastory.org. And if you just are a little bit interested in this stuff, pick up one of these books, read one of these articles. This stuff is just really interesting. So I think a lot of teachers are finding it really interesting. They're learning things about reading and how it works, and even just how the English language works that they
Yeah.
never knew. And it's just very exciting for them to finally, they're changing the way they teach and they're seeing kids respond. Not all kids, this is no panacea. This is not gonna like,
Sure.
there's a lot more than just instruction that affects how well a kid reads, right? We
Right,
do
sure.
know that there's a lot of other factors that are real, but instruction can really matter. And kids who have lots of barriers in their life and lots of reasons why they may not become good readers can become good readers if you teach them how to do it. And you are giving them one of their greatest chances they have, one of the
Right.
greatest gifts
Sure.
to towards social mobility, honestly, if you help them become a good reader when they're young. So teachers have had a mixed response. Parents, there are so many parents out here who know this, either because they've really lived it with the problem in their face for years and years, or they're maybe like you or a lot of other parents who have just been sort of, it's been nagging at you for a long
Yeah,
time.
right.
You're not quite sure what's going on with your kids. So there's a lot of response there. And then, there's been a lot of response from policymakers, and I feel sort of mixed feelings about the response. Policy is kind of a blunt force instrument, right? And so I think there are a lot of people in schools who have really been looking up saying, like, we need help. I hear from teachers all the time, we need our superintendent, we need our school board, we need our lawmakers to do something about this. We need better materials, we need more training. And so that stuff is starting to happen. But then, some of these laws can become, they're not all perfect.
Yeah, right, sure.
Implementing this stuff is really hard. There's resistance and blowback. Things aren't always going well out there in the real world. So it's mixed, which is one reason why I'm hoping to report on it for years to come, because I think there's still a lot of unanswered questions, and just about all kinds of things, like
Sure.
older kids. What do you do with a kid who's in high school?
That's right.
All kinds of, and then there's all kinds of stuff sort of document and investigate, and actually to like and in a sort of solutions oriented sort of way to be like, okay, so where are things changing, and where school districts where you might not expect there to be big changes, where are they changing and why? What happened? What changed? And also, what are people changing that's not working well? Some of these laws are calling for schools to do certain things, and I think it's really important to say, well, this isn't working. This law wasn't a good idea, or this new curriculum doesn't have all that the school needs, or maybe it's not the curriculum itself, but how well was it implemented? How are they
Right,
doing that?
right.
So
And
there's a lot left to.
so much of that too is that it's not really a one size fits all program, right? Just as you say,
Absolutely.
yeah.
And I think that's one of the, I think one size fits all. There's certain ways that people are able to sort of smear and push back all of this stuff. And one size fits all is one of them. Like, oh, this is all going to lead to like one size fits all. As far as I can tell, in the places that I've, that where they're really doing this thoughtfully, I'm not seeing this as one size fits all at all.
Right.
What I'm seeing is that the schools are doing a better job trying to identify the kids who are struggling and why they're struggling, and then thinking very hard about what needs to be done about that, and doing innovative things. Like, for example, there's a school, I'm talking to some people at a school later today. This isn't like a revelation, but what they're doing is they're really doing a good job figuring out where kids are in those early foundational skills. And when they identify kids who are struggling, they're basically putting them into groups. And sometimes you'll have first, second, and third graders in one group.
Oh,
And
wow.
then they're assigning the teachers to work with the kids basically on where they are on the sequence of skills that they need to learn, recognizing that some kids in first grade are at the level of third graders and some third graders at the level of first graders. And so they have a program. They have one of the program that people say, big, bad program. They have a program, but it's helping them do this. It's helping them figure out how to differentiate the instruction.
That's fantastic. And that's really what it needs to be. And it's fascinating. What would you say was your biggest, have you had a moment where you've sort of like one thing that stands out as the one thing that you learned that really sort of the lightning moment, for lack of a better way to put it?
Well, certainly the lightning moment came when sort of crystallizing and understanding the idea that's at the center of Sold a Story. And I mentioned this earlier, which is this isn't just about phonics instruction.
Sure.
It's not so, and this is an important thing because I think one of the things that happens in education is we learn new things, we decide things need to be done in a new way, and then we add that on. We give teachers a new initiative that they need to learn about, a new
Absolutely.
curriculum they need to use, a new thing, and we just keep adding on. We're piling on to teachers, and teachers are just not able to do a good job with all these things that are being asked of them. And you end up with this kind of mess where they're being asked to do more than they could possibly do. So they're doing the things they can, or the things they like, or the things they think work best. They have some huge mountainous curriculum, and they're just doing the things in it that they understand. And it's
Sure.
not adding up to coherence for a child. So I think that was one of the big things that why I've stayed on this for so long is I was like, everyone's been fighting about phonics instruction and saying whether this is phonics or not. But the key thing that I think is missing is that teachers, many, just didn't understand how children learn to read. So they didn't understand why phonics instruction is so important. So that's really one of the revelations. It's not just that kids need phonics. Why do they need phonics? What is it about understanding the sound structure of the language and how the letters and the words correspond to each other? Why is this that so critical for your brain? Why is it that without that you can't become a good reader? And when you explain that to people and they understand, oh, here's why phonics instruction matters, but also why it's not all about phonics instruction. For example, what I said before, the way you
Sure.
become a good reader is you can connect the spelling of the word, the pronunciation, and the meaning. The meaning's really important. Kids come into school with very different vocabularies. We have to be doing so much better, so much more
Sure.
at helping kids with like knowledge and vocabulary. This isn't just about teaching them how to sound out words.
Yeah.
So I think that was the revelation for me. It's like, oh, there's this narrative that this is about whether or not schools teach phonics or not, but that's not quite it.
Right.
There's something else. And it's really important to recognize that we've had certain ideas, theories about how people learn to read that came about when no one knew how people learned to read. We didn't really know. And then starting in the 1970s, all this really groundbreaking research really answered a lot of questions. We don't know the answers to all questions, but we found out a huge amount just about like, how do we even do that? How do we even read? And what you realize is if you can have a basic understanding of that, then if teachers can have a basic understanding of that, the question of what you need to do and why you need to do it and how to do it and how much of something a certain kid needs, it makes so much more sense. And this is what I think many teachers are having this experience right now. Like they're sort of blown away by, wow, I start to understand the why of this and I get it. And then they can become better critical consumers of the programs and the initiatives that are coming at them.
Right.
They can
That
ask
makes
the
sense.
questions, and I think that's one of the things that's been happening for years for a lot of teachers is they've just been sort of expected to sort of accept things like now we're doing this and now we're doing this. And there's a sort of blind acceptance and, and they know, like give them some of the rationale. They eat it up. That's what they want.
Yeah. And
And
that's
what do
probably,
they all want? They all want to teach their kids to
I was
read,
going to say, and that's why they went into the line of work that they're in. Emily, I can't even believe it, but you and I have been talking for 30 minutes. And
Oh
the
my,
big
well, I don't
thing,
shut up.
well, no, but this is fascinating. We could talk another hour. What's next for Sold the Story? First off, I'll make sure that the link to the show, because I know that everybody that hears our conversation is going to want to be following and
Yeah,
listening to
please.
what you're doing, because I know you've got some new episodes coming, and likely more as you plan ahead.
Yeah.
Anything else we can preview for you that you expect to be
Sure. Well,
offering?
actually, we're translating it into Spanish, and it's
Oh,
coming out
that's
within the
awesome.
next few weeks.
Oh,
So
awesome.
there's going to be a Spanish version of Sold a Story and two new episodes. All of that should be out within the next few weeks. And then
Congratulations.
we're going to figure out what comes next after that. Not sure.
That's so awesome. Keep up this fantastic work. I can't wait to share this conversation with our audience and with our friends who are all paying attention and really appreciating the work that you're doing. The hardest question I'll ask you today, and I didn't prep you in advance, so now I'm going to put you on the
Uh-oh.
spot, but I'll ask you for a recommendation for a future guest for the show.
Oh, wow. Gosh. Oh, no. I'm so in this world of this reading stuff that I'm going to think of someone who's just on this topic.
And there's no bad answer. And there's also, I can send you someone after the fact, because that's also an answer.
Well, have you ever read Marianne Wolfe's book? So speaking about what you talked about your own kids and the competition with the digital age. So Marianne Wolfe is a reading scientist who's written several really, really good books, but her most recent one, she might even have a more recent one since then, but it's called Reader Come Home. And it's about reading in the digital age. And it's about the idea of deep reading. What does it mean to deeply read something? How we are losing it. All of us are losing it. I am, wow. You are, I'm sure. And then our children have never experienced it. At least it sounds like we both experienced that, really getting lost in a book and being bored and lying on your bed and staring at a tree. And she is great. And her research around this stuff is fascinating. And she's just really good at talking about these big ideas about what reading really means.
Yeah.
The importance of reading in our world and for a democracy, for a literate society. It's good stuff.
That's amazing. Well, I'm going to put her on my list and let her know that you recommended her. But also, please. Too, you mentioned that you've got a reading list too for on Save the Story Sold the Stories website. So I'll make sure that I'm linked to that too, because I think that would be interesting for listeners as well to know that there's other resources and other things to be following. I am thrilled, Emily, to have had you here today. Thank you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, there you have it, another episode of the Friday Reporter podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in. I love having this show. I love you to be part of it. Thanks again. Thanks to PR Daily for being a partner, and thanks to the folks at Big Wig Podcast for letting us be part of their network. See you soon.